It's Monday, April 24th, 1989. This is Hearing Room C, the Senate Labor Committee.
The Senate Labor Committee will come to order. We have a chore for Ashley, if you want the instructor to do that. We got a couple of items on the agenda. 10:15, the infamous Hillcrest McLaren bill. Did Mr. Willis escape? Why don't you come on up and answer a question here? We're in work session on the bill. And tell me a little bit about the, now the president of the board has appointed a, that's an ad hoc group, will meet, make a report, and disband. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, but one of the recommendations that they might make is some permanent kind of oversight process.
That is within their, Mr. Chair, for the record, Alan Willis with the Port of Portland. That is in their purview to be able to do that. If you'd like, I could go through a few moments of a brief outline of what their scope is, and including some of the things they'll look into and their timeline.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like that. I would appreciate it.
Again, the panel that's been appointed by Commission President Ames includes two of our commissioners, Commissioner George Miller and Commissioner Mildred Schwab. Chairing the committee is Don McClave, who's the executive officer of the Portland Chamber of Commerce, Chris Thomas, who used to be the attorney for the city of Portland, and Sho DeZono, who is the co-owner, I believe, of a large travel agency in the area. He's been very active in tourism and other kinds of issues in the metropolitan area and, in fact, around the state. Their scope of work includes a look into relevant information of past complaints and port actions with regard to those complaints since January of 1986, and includes a specific emphasis on looking at the complaints, reviewing our response to those complaints, looking at the internal procedures that we use to investigate, that the police use to investigate those complaints. Also included will be looks at the present physical layout and future plans at the airport in terms of the parking and the circulation system, reviewing of the relationships between federal regulations, those of the Federal Aviation Administration, the port, state laws, and our collective bargaining agreements with respect to the safety and security needs of the traveling public, and finally, a review of whether or not enough or more specific customer relations training is needed for airport police employees. They will prepare a report with recommendations, a final report with recommendations to the Port of Portland Commission by June 30th. A preliminary report is due out earlier in the month, perhaps by the end of May. The committee has been divided at this point, Mr. Chair, into two subcommittees. One is looking at what we call the bricks and mortar aspects of the situation, just the circulation, the layout, the organization of the airport, et cetera. Another, headed by Chris Thomas, the former Portland City Attorney, is reviewing actual police procedures and practices from his knowledge of years of working with the City of Portland on those kinds of things. Preliminary reports of these two subcommittees will be presented to the full committee at its May 2nd meeting. And they will proceed from there. There is a May 18th meeting at which public testimony will be taken from those who wish to talk to the committee. All the meetings will be subject to the public meetings law, and the final report is due out, as I say, by June 30th with a preliminary report expected sometime in early June.
Okay. So that when did you say the final report? I missed that.
The end of June.
end of June, so...
That's due to the Port of Portland Commission.
Okay, so it may be we will, with any luck at all, we will have adjourned and dispersed across the countryside back to our homes before that final report is brought into port for their adoption, or I assume they can reject it or amend it, or, I mean, they then act on what they get, right?
The Port Commission would, yes.
So that might be July, August, September. We don't know when action might come.
What I've been told by Executive Director Waddell and Deputy Director Supak is basically they want to act on as expeditiously as possible. We'll get recommendations to the Port Commission ASAP. And the reason I mentioned the preliminary report is because that's one that's expected to be fairly complete, and that may, in fact, be completed before you do adjourn sine die.
Well, I don't know.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hill.
I think I expressed some concerns at the last meeting. In fact, we had a conversation in the hall before session today. But I'd like to summarize what my concerns are. First of all, this kind of a problem isn't unique to the Port of Portland. It occasionally occurs with other municipalities. And we see it from time to time. The city of Portland has had similar problems with police and citizen complaints. And they've instituted investigations and have put forward a formal procedure to receive complaints and to look into them. I think one of the differences between the Port of Portland and the city of Portland or any other municipality is that the port is appointed by the governor. It's a creature of the state. It's created by statute, and it really isn't directly accountable to a constituency. The city of Portland or a county or any other city or county in the state, the governing board or commission is always at risk of being recalled or being thrown out of office if they don't perform satisfactorily. Port of Portland doesn't run that risk. Any other municipality and city responds in regards to that risk of being removed from office to these kinds of complaints fairly quickly and efficiently. But the port doesn't necessarily have that pressure to respond. So far from what the testimony revealed on Friday and your comments today, it seems to me the port is sincerely attempting to respond. The concern I have is, will it stick? Will there be a change institutionalized that will try to prevent these kinds of problems from happening again and respond to complaints if citizens have complaints in the future in a fair and objective way? So that's really the basis of my concern. I toyed with some different ideas of having a third party evaluate complaints. Another idea I had was to put a sunset in the law on the Port of Portland's police authority, which would require you to come back and to talk to us again about how things are going in a couple of years. I also toyed with the idea of putting language in the statute to require an objective third-party complaint procedure for things like this, and just stick it in there, you shall have such a procedure. I think I'll be, I would frankly feel more comfortable with that kind of assurance, but I've had conversations with members of the committee, and I've been convinced that we can probably do a lot by allowing your procedure to proceed and you, the port, to do its best and the Citizen Advisory Committee to do its best and the recommendations be taken seriously and energy be put into implementing those recommendations. And then if we still have problems in a couple of years, we'll look at it again. And I promise you, I feel strongly enough about it that if we still have problems like we have now, in a couple of years, I'll be introducing the bill myself to do something more dramatic. But I guess the better part of valor now is to let you know that it's real important to some people that the airport be hospitable to visitors, and we solve these problems, and we don't get a nationwide reputation for, quote, beating up people. We can't afford that, and it's of statewide interest because that's the big international airport that we have. So leave it at that. I hope the process works well and the problems are solved. And if they aren't, then there'll be continued interest on my part. But if you solve the problems, then I'll abide by your process.
Well, I would, I don't know whether there are other comments in the committee. What I would appreciate is that when your committee makes its preliminary recommendations to the full committee, your subs make preliminary recommendations. I don't know whether the committee cares or wants to see the technical side or the, you know, what we're interested in, I think, is the citizen complaints, reviews, and adjudication of those complaints, and those kinds of things, the PR aspects. Also, if possible, you could send those to the committee, and then when the after the full committee makes its recommendation to the port commission, maybe you could send those to the co-chairs of the interim committee, and we'd be advised what we needed to. Because I think from, well, I'll let you answer those questions.
The answer to all those questions is yes, and I guess I'd go ahead and let you know, Mr. Chair, that even if we get beyond the session, and even if this isn't the interim committee, I'd be happy to keep all five of the members of this committee informed on what has happened and what will happen in that regard, if you'd like.
Okay. The only other thing I would make is a recommendation is that, for what it's worth, and pass it on to the folks who are on the committee, that the same is true in the city of Eugene when we had this problem, and the city of Portland when they had it, was an external citizen review, some kind of external review outside the, you know, outside the vertical organization of the commission, the administration, the airport management supervisor, you know, et cetera, shift supervisor. When people look at that and say, oh, okay, that's all in house, but has anybody ever looked at these guys' homework? But then you already.
But I didn't catch that last comment.
But I said, I assume that you already knew that.
Yeah.
And the committee does.
Yeah. In fact, they will take a look at that. I have no idea what they might recommend, but I can probably guess there will be some changes in the way complaints are handled now that they will recommend. And again, would be happy to keep you informed of those. And finally, I guess just a word in our interest, just that, as Senator Hill has talked about, we sincerely and honestly, and I know the airport police do as well, take the allegations and the possibilities of these kind of things getting out around the country as seriously, if not more so, than you do, and it's something we don't want. And I know the Port Commission, I speak for President Ames and Executive Director Bob Waddell, you know, that doesn't help us market airlines or anybody else into the state, and so we will want to take effective action as soon as possible and ensure that that kind of thing doesn't happen again, depending on what the investigation tells us.
Senator Schumacher?
Chair, just let me comment that I appreciate the consensus of the committee that recognize this is a serious problem, but also give the port the first opportunity to clean up its own act before we come down with a heavy legislative hammer on it. And I think that is an appropriate way to conclude this, and I appreciate your testimony and the testimony of the people from the court and of the people who appeared to testify before us.
I would just echo the sentiments of the committee. It's obvious you aren't taking this lightly. If I thought you were, I'd be a lot more amenable to making someone else responsible for this, but I think you're taking every effort to do what you can to resolve the problem, and that's all anyone can ask of you. So I think we're doing the right thing.
Okay. Sounds like you dodged a bullet here, Mr. Wilson, well, did the port, at least as far as this amendment at this time and this session is concerned. And I appreciate being informed of the committee's recommendations and the port's actions. You report to the interim committees of those actions.
We'll keep you posted.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, we've got Senate Bill 1015 before us then with the Danielson Amendment, which has been adopted. Were there further amendments that we had? I don't think so.
Mr. Chairman?
Is there a bill in here somewhere?
Senator Hill.
I'm not proposing any amendments, but I just wanted to I wanted to note for the record that I would support an opportunity to extend the coverage for police and firefighters' retirement to county parole and probation officers. In fact, I've introduced a bill to that effect on my own. I understand that that's not appropriate for this particular vehicle at this particular time, but I do want to put on the record that I do support that, and my support for the amendment deleting that section, that subsection, should not be taken as lack of support for including parole and probation officers. I still hope to have a hearing on that issue on its own merits.
Okay, noted for the record. All right, is there a motion on the bill as amended?
I'll move the bill as amended.
Senator Shoemaker moves Senate Bill 1015 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Further discussion? If not, we'll call the roll. Senator House is excused.
I don't know.
Senator Gretzky?
Aye.
Senator Hill?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Chair Kearns?
Aye. Motion's adopted. We now have Senate Bill 1051.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hill, we've got a Hayden Gross version dated 4/21. Is that where we're working from?
Right.
Okay. Okay. What is this?
Mr. Chairman, what 4/21 is a hand-engrossed version that is made up of amendments I propose to the committee, worked over after some conversation with committee members. And it should represent a more successful version of the bill.
Say that again.
The amendment, the hand-engrossed bill includes my amendments, Mr. Chairman, to make the bill more workable.
Okay. I also have an amendment here from Sheriff Dave Burks from the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Have you seen that one?
I've just seen it now. This is the first I've seen it.
Okay.
It kind of goes against the flow, Mr. Chairman, if I can speak to that on its own.
Sure.
The bill currently provides that an employee who determines that, who has reasonable grounds to believe someone receiving services or assistance from a state agency is a wanted felon, that they should notify their immediate supervisor and also call the state police. I'm proposing to amend that to provide that they notify their immediate supervisor or a person designated by the agency
by rule,
and that person who's designated or the immediate supervisor should call the state police. It looks like Sheriff Burks is suggesting that in addition that person notify the local police or county sheriff. The intent in having a single number at the state police is to allow the state police to have a single intake person or persons at a particular point who takes the information and checks it against the law enforcement data system list to see if that person is actually a wanted person. And then the state police would have the responsibility to contact local law enforcement authorities. So that was the intent. It looks like Sheriff Burks would like direct contact.
Well, I assume it's cumulative. It's either or. It's contact the Oregon State Police, local police or county sheriff. Your choice.
Mr.
Is there anybody representing the Sheriff's Association here? I got anybody? Okay.
Anybody from the state police? Mr. Chairman, I think I'd prefer to leave it with the state police because they said they could handle it, they could check it against the law enforcement data system computer list, and they can call the local law enforcement.
Well, that one, I believe you're right. Unless there's somebody dying for the Sheriff's Association amendment. Why don't we start then on page one and we can work our way through here.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, you can see we're adding amendments to Chapter 659. Chapter 659 is the bully chapter, Bureau of Labor and Industries.
Go ahead.
Okay. On the second page, the first...
Excuse me, you're also amending 240316 instead of 240740. You're repealing 240740.
Right.
Tell me what that all means.
Okay, can we get to it? It's in the later section of the bill.
Okay, all right.
But the first point is that we're adding this law to Boley's chapter, 659, and previously we hadn't assigned it to any particular chapter. It was kind of an orphan. On the second page, between line 28 and 29, we provide that except as specified in subsection 2 of section 5 of this act, comma, authorized an employee to disclose information required to be kept confidential under state or federal law, rule, or regulation. So we are including state or as into that section so that if something is required to be confidential under state or federal law, rule, or regulation, it may not be disclosed. So we're protecting the confidentiality of those items and information that state or federal law protects. And except for subsection 2 of section 5, subsection 2 provides that confidentiality requirements of state or federal law shall not prevent disclosure of the wanted felons to the state police, but otherwise that information must be kept confidential. That's what the exception of subsection 2 of section 5 refers to, which is down at the bottom of page 2. Now lines A through F on page 2 provide that this act is not intended to, sub 6, prohibit a public employer from establishing by rule a procedure whereby an employee who wishes to disclose information described in paragraph B of subsection 1 of section 3 of this act may disclose the information first to the supervisor, or if the supervisor is involved, to the supervisor next higher. But the employer must protect the employee against retaliatory or disciplinary action by any supervisor for such disclosure. This would allow an agency to adopt a procedure, an internal procedure, for disclosing the things that are protected by the act within the agency first, seeking to resolve those things within the agency, if possible, prior to public disclosure. That's the intent of that section. Down in section 5 on lines 42 and 42A, we add the language that when the wanted felon is found, that the employee shall promptly and without delay notify the employee's immediate supervisor or a person designated by the agency by rule to receive such notice. Then lines 43 through 45, the supervisor or person designated by the agency shall notify the Oregon State Police promptly and without delay of the information supplied by the employee. And the next page, the notification shall include the notification to the supervisor, and then by the supervisor to the state police shall include disclosure of the name and address, etc. And then lines 4 to 6 of page 3 protect the information. The information disclosed under this section shall only be used by law enforcement officials to verify the existence of felony warrant for arrest and apprehend the person if felony warrant for arrest exists. So this information can only be disclosed to this extent, and to the supervisor, and then by the supervisor or the appointed person to the state police. And then we're striking subsection 7, which...
Can I jump in there?
Sure.
Oh, I just remembered something. What do we do about going back up here and giving the state police the sole authority? You got a local jurisdiction, and when Sheriff Burks talked to me about it, he said, well, you know, you end up with somebody in the courthouse who's across the hall from the sheriff's department having to call the state police, or somebody in the city hall across the corridor from the city police having to call the state police. and not being permitted to otherwise notify the folks in the political subdivision that they work for. In other words, they have to call the state police, but they're not, by exclusion, they're not permitted to notify the police agency for their own employer, city or county.
Well,
I'm not trying to make trouble for you. I'm just.
I
recall what the argument was with Sheriff Burke.
I can describe the intent. The intent is to make it very, very clear as to who should contact whom. And the state police have the broadest authority, of course, statewide jurisdiction. And they have immediate, they can set somebody up at a phone with immediate access to the law enforcement data system. They probably have somebody there already with one phone number statewide. And every agency just has to know the one phone number. And it would make it much easier for the agencies to respond rather than trying to find the appropriate person at the local law enforcement office. The state police then would call the local law enforcement folks in that jurisdiction.
If they wanted to.
If they
wanted to. Call the sheriff and say, somebody in your office across the hall is calling me, and we got a warrant out on this guy for armed robbery. You want to go over there and put the collar on?
Mm-hmm. Once they check on the computer.
All right.
I'm not sure that every local law enforcement jurisdiction has immediate access to the law enforcement data system, data bank. I don't think they do.
Okay.
So, and that's the most efficient way to check for an outstanding felony warrant for arrest. Section 7, we're substituting new language. The reason we're doing this is because the existing language, and this is the repeal that is at the head of the bill. We're repealing 2740, because it's redundant with the language of the bill. In other words, we supersede the language existing in 240740, and it's easiest to make to accomplish what 240740 accomplishes with new language. So we're substituting new language for the old language. What that section currently does is protect the identity of an employee who discloses information which the employee believes shows violation of law or rule, gross waste of funds, etc., in an investigation. So when there's an investigation and they question the employee and the employee says, yeah, I think so-and-so did such and such, currently they're protected and their identity is protected in an investigation. So we're continuing that protection, but instead of listing all of the things that they're protected if they reveal, we're simply referring back to matters described in paragraphs A and B of subsection 1 of section 3. So we're consistent. And that includes gross waste of funds, abuse of authority, etc. And also, sub B, we're protecting the employee who identified the wanted felon and reported their name. And also, sub 2, we're providing that the Bureau of Labor and Industry shall, by rule, enforce this particular act. Now, the purpose of making BOLI the rulemaking and enforcement authority is they have jurisdiction through their rulemaking over all sections of government, and thus will extend the protection to all employees, whereas the Personnel Division in the existing law only has jurisdiction over the executive branch. They don't have jurisdiction over the judiciary and legislative branches. So the enforcement of this will be as an unfair labor practice, and the Bureau of Labor and Industries would enforce it uniformly. Section 8.
Mr. Chair, just a drafting question on Section 7. You talk about the identity of the employee who discloses information which the employee reasonably believes shows any of the following, and then you go to the following, and they all have within them a reasonable belief by the employee standard.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if it's necessary to have it twice. In other words, whether we shouldn't simply say the identity of the employee who discloses any of the following shall not be disclosed.
That's probably true.
Because
a reasonable belief
is built into each of those standards. I just checked it.
Yeah.
Okay, that's correct. Why don't we correct that, Mr. Chairman? I have no objection.
Okay, discloses information.
Discloses any of the following.
Shall not be disclosed.
I think that does it.
Yep.
Any of the following information.
No,
any of the following.
Discloses any of the following.
Okay. Who discloses any of the following shall not be disclosed without the written consent.
Okay, that's fine.
Matters described in those subparagraphs and reports required.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chairman, Section 8 is existing law. We're changing it a little bit. We're rearranging it so that we're making sure we hold...
Where is Section 8?
It's on page 3.
Oh, there it is.
Line 28.
Yep.
It is an unlawful employment practice for an employer, that's current law, to do a number of things there. And we're striking the new language. Our intent here is to hold that language harmless. That applies to all employers, including private employers. We don't want to mess with private employers. So the intent here is to hold private employers harmless. And instead add B, add the semicolon or sub B, a public employer is defined as Section 2 of this 1989 Act to violate Sections 3 to 5 and 7 of this 1989 Act. So that's the new language we're adding, and that is that would make it an unfair labor employment practice for the public employer to violate this Act, the effective parts of this Act. Okay, and then we've got Section...
for the person who actually blows the whistle on malfeasance, nonfeasance, whether it's not criminal, it borders on criminality, the kind of stupidity that's going on, whatever it is, and that the kind of harassment and retaliation that's going to come, for which there is psychic damage and the kind of stress and ulcers the result, lack of sleep and all the rest of it, from just being, you know, ding, 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 ding for the rest of your natural life as you're trying to get to the gold watch and the pension. And so at some point, being able to come back and say, hey, whoa on all that. I've had it. I'm taking you to court because all of this arises out of this incident. And I've got no remedy against you. I've got a statute that says you're not supposed to do this, but I got no way to enforce it. See what I'm saying? And you got to get them in front of a judge that says, hey, what you did stinks. I've heard the evidence. These guys made a crappy case. You've been harassing this person unmercifully as a result of him doing what this law required. Pay the man and stop doing that. Mm-hmm. I mean that's the only effective way I see it. Otherwise, you for all I know, you might get recovery. You probably couldn't even get recovery of your attorney fees if you haven't been demoted or lost any income. One of the unlawful employment practices.
Isn't there, Mr. Chairman, a broad limitation on punitive damages to public agencies?
Yeah.
Yes.
So we don't need to cite that.
You need to.
In other words, it goes up to the lid and that's it. You don't go over that.
Yeah, what's the lid? 2,500? 2,500, I think.
Well, under the torts claims or the... Last session, you passed the limit on liability for public bodies, and that's $100,000 for one single incident. But it also prohibits award of punitive damages, as I read it. So you would have to exempt yourself from that.
Those are compensatory damages?
$100,000 general and special, that's compensatory.
Well,
and then prohibits any punitives.
Well, we might have a hard time rocking that boat.
Well, could I go after them for what falls under the general special damages? Is that also recovery, or is there pain and suffering? And
it says for all claims. So that would mean some kind of loss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to prove it. Usually what happens, and Senator Hill, you know as well as I do, what in the history of these things, what happens is, person is the whistleblower, is a hero for 2 or 3 days, and then the spotlight moves on, and that person becomes the largest pariah ever found in that government. Okay? And then they become the target of abuse.
That's what's happened with the federal government. Whistleblowers
exactly.
Are handled
better. Yeah. They just become a pariah.
A difficult time.
And you're going to get it. That's it. You're dead man. It's one thing to be sent to coverage. It's another one to just be treated with...
Yeah. I'm not sure if if special damages, it says no award for damages on any claim shall include punitive damages. This is existing statute. Mm-hmm. The limitation imposed by the section on individual claimants includes damages claimed for loss of services or loss of support arising out of the same tort. But special damages, I'm not sure what that includes.
That'd be actual out-of-pocket expenses.
Special damages.
Your counseling, you go to the psychologist, your counsel.
Loss of wages, medical treatment.
Yeah, you get mileage to and from and the cost of actually going to the counselor and the psychologist, your prescription medicines for tranquilizers, the vitamins, the, you know, et cetera, all the regimen that you're doing to combat what's happening to you on the job. Because you're not going to go off the job because it's your livelihood and your family depends on it.
As a practical matter, I think that's going to be a problem no matter what. I mean,
yeah.
People aren't idiots.
Yeah.
And they're going to think real hard before they do this anyway,
yeah.
Law or no law, and I think that's just a built-in problem. You know?
Yeah, what I'm suggesting is that we have some protection in the hands of the person who actually blows the whistle, and that being in addition to general special damages, that if the activity is egregious, just flagrant, continuing, long-term kind of practice, that they have the ability to hammer the government for the same kind of punies we gave in this other case.
I don't
set a limit of 25.
Can you levy punitive damages against the government? I don't think you
we
can.
We have to.
No, you
we
have to.
We have to give an exemption to the current law in order to set a limitation.
With all due respect, I think you're on the verge of kind of almost making a whole other bill here that some other people might want to testify on.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I'm sort of wondering if you got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we.
I'm getting a message.
A problem if we try to bring in the punies. I'd like to make clear that the special damages, et cetera, are all available.
Well, they
to
are.
Remedy.
Are they not?
What do we have
what
to
do we
say?
Have to, do we have to reference
to,
it?
To make it clear.
To make it compensatory damages?
Yeah. Well, to include everything that's currently allowed by law against a public body.
Okay, you need to reference a different part of 659.121, which you currently only reference it general. 659.035 is only referenced in the remedy section for unlawful employment practice in regard to equitable relief, which includes reinstatement or back pay. So you need to include a reference to 659.035 in another section.
Okay.
Or you need to create a whole new section saying for violations of the Whistleblower Act, you can have compensatory
okay.
damages.
Ms. Chairman,
under that statute. Okay, I'd rather have a separate section and set it out.
Ms. Chairman, I'll suggest a new section 9. Because that'll come right after the unlawful employment section.
Yeah, let's put it
and
right
then
there.
Renumber section 9 in our mock-up, and renumber section 10 and renumber section 11. So we'll stick in a new section
okay.
9.
That'll do what?
Section 9.
ORS 1.
Well, shouldn't we just include new language that violations of sections blank, blank, blank of this act, or civil suit for injunctive, injunctive relief. Maybe we should have counsel do it and just get our intent clear.
Okay, you can't do punitive, so you want compensatory damages or $200, whichever is greater, or you just want compensatory damages?
Now, what have I done for general or special? Do I need to further reference something to say that I've got a right of action to come after the employer, public employer, for general and special damages?
Well, I think
or have I done that?
The actual damages you're looking at are already included under the subsection 1 of 659.121. Do you want to look at the damages?
Well, I'd like actual damages, I'd like compensatory damages, I'd like special damages.
Right.
In other words, the bunch except for punitive.
Okay.
And I'd like them
as
to the extent allowed by 30270. We don't need to reference them.
No.
That's the basic.
That's for any public body.
Okay, that applies to any public body. Mm-hmm.
Okay, is that agreeable to folks?
Well, I'm not. I think I want some chance to think about it. We're really kind of departing from a state standard now that allows you to seek injunctive relief essentially reinstatement and back pay.
The trick is
unlawful employment practices. We're now extending that to specifically permit damages.
Well, Mr. Chairman. This goes back to the discussion on the civil rights violations. The person who's aggrieved has to retain an attorney. And if you're going to fork over most of your back pay that you eventually win to your attorney for legal costs, it's hardly worth your while.
I guess I kind of feel like Senator Grinsky did in a way that this is enough of a departure that it deserves its own debate with opportunity for public testimony and all. And maybe we shouldn't poison the Whistleblower Act by that debate. Why don't we go ahead with this and then have another bill that deals with opening up the relief that you can get for this kind of an unlawful employment practice. Okay. Let a debate occur on that on its own merits.
Well, if we have the bill the way it is now, Annette, tell us again what kind of relief will be provided with the way it's framed now. What's available?
Well, it's difficult to see that you would have any relief unless you were actually fired, because it's equitable relief, including reinstatement or back pay. I suppose you could say part of your equitable relief was you were denied a promotion, so you might get that.
If you're counting the paper in the warehouse.
Right. Well, but otherwise, there's not many other damages that you would get.
If we don't have a way for people to protect themselves from retaliation through their own motion, their own action,
right,
we're going to lose a lot of the effectiveness of the legislation.
I think that's right.
So we need something. I think we need something. Let's forget punitive. Let's stick close to what's broadly accepted in the statutes already. But I think we need something. At least we need compensable damages. We need to have, if someone goes out and finds an attorney, proves to the court that they're being stuck in the warehouse, counting paper was retaliation for their blowing the whistle because the boss hired his brother-in-law instead of hiring somebody who's qualified, they ought to at least get their costs back for proving that point, as well as being made whole in terms of their career.
Yeah, that's really,
I think you're probably right, but we should have a hearing on that.
All right.
Because I think there are people that may have strong feelings on both sides of that.
That's no problem. We can arrange that. What are we doing Monday night? What do we got on tap Monday evening?
Tonight?
No. Yeah,
week from today. Is the first?
Because we're going to have
a meeting tonight?
No, sir.
Thank you.
No. We're going to keep plugging away here until we get it done. I'd hate to throw, I don't know that we have another bill that would have this appropriate relating clause. Do we want to chase this bill with something, or do you want to put it in this bill?
Well, I wouldn't want to endanger the bill, because without the compensatory damages, et cetera, there's still much value in the bill. I think if we allow the own action and compensatory damages to the aggrieved person, we're going to have a stronger bill. It's more likely to be utilized. But let's see.
What do we have? Well, here's what I would suggest we do then. Let's put on next Monday's agenda, a invited testimony from the one of the League of Oregon City, Association of Oregon Counties, school boards, and the executive department. That ought to cover everybody, don't you think?
We might have, we do have a couple odds and ends that would work.
Trial lawyers, I suppose.
Provides for civil remedy for unlawful employment practices.
Argue for it.
Oh, just a second. What?
That's Senate Bill 296.
Still in committee? Yeah.
Nope, gone.
Oh, that one's gone.
We used that.
Try 414.
414. 414 relating to civil rights proceedings. That's my bill, and it's available. We could carry on the debate there.
Can I ask a question?
Senator Grinsky.
What about Bureau of Labor and Industries? Can't they spin some regulations out of this bill for enforcement purposes that might include some of the stuff we're talking about?
Not tort liability. They couldn't
not
touch
tort,
that.
No, but...
I don't think they've got the ability to fine anybody.
They have the authority to reinstate, and order the agency to cease and desist their actions that are illegal. but they don't have the authority to make the aggrieved person whole, I don't think.
Well, they do in terms of negotiating a settlement.
Negotiating a settlement.
The thing I would like to reiterate is that as bad as this one incident was, it was one incident.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking that maybe, you know, you may have enough here to not see another one in the foreseeable future. I realize I appreciate the concerns of wanting to make everybody whole, and I appreciate that, but I'm a little concerned also that I'd like to see this pass.
Mm-hmm.
And the more stuff we divide in there.
Huh? Yeah. I think we've divided the question.
I agree with the senators at that end of the table. I think we ought to divide the question.
Okay.
If we're going to pursue the other side, which I think is worth pursuing.
I'd like to at least pursue that as an issue. It doesn't mean that we'll use one of the vehicles we've got. Okay. Then we can drag in somebody from the trial lawyers and the usual list of suspects from the public employee unions.
Mm-hmm. There's another one. No, that one's coming.
You can find the bill.
Tell them they have to be brief. Oh, we can find the bill. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, we can find the bill.
They have to be brief to the point of an amendment relating to recovery for someone who is wronged on this 1051.
Well, you currently allow recovery of compensatory damages for someone who violates the handicap provision in Chapter 659. So it's not. It is existing.
Mm-hmm. Well. You could throw that in there. That wouldn't be too tough, would it?
I mean, that wouldn't be hard to do. All you have to do is reference.
That would be compensatory only.
Uh-huh.
Would that be acceptable as at least a starting point?
Yes. It'd be fine for me.
Mr. Chairman, then I'd move that we fold in a reference to that particular statute for compensatory, and then we carry on the discussion in the separate vehicle regarding general damages for this sort of activity. We can also fold in the discussion of some other unlawful employment practices that don't have general damages.
Okay, good.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Let's do it. Then we will amend the reference to that compensatory damages.
Before we leave this.
That would be Section 9.
Regarding the suggestion that we broaden Section 8 to provide that it's an unlawful employment practice to discriminate under this act,
mm-hmm.
That might be accomplished over on Section 3, sub, what is it, 2, on line 16 of page 2, just by providing it is an unlawful employment practice for a public employer to invoke or impose any disciplinary action against an employee, so forth. Wouldn't that do it?
Well, that, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hill.
I don't think that would quite work.
Well,
we could cite back. We could cite back the other section.
We could provide in Section 8 that it's an unlawful employment practice to violate sub 2 of Section 3.
Okay, that would work.
That would work.
Sub 2, Section 3. Okay, let me get it straight, Mr. Chairman, for Annette and myself. On the third page, 34 A, B, and C, we're talking about a public employer as defined in, and then we're going to itemize, we're going to repeat Section 2 of the Act. As defined in Section 2 of this Act, to violate Sections 3 to 5 and 7 of this 1989 Act, but we're going to put into that the definition of disciplinary action. So it's itemized.
I think Senator Shoemaker was suggesting to violate Section 3, Subsection 2, Friend 2.
Section 3, Subsection 2.
Two of Section 3 and 7 of this 1989 Act. So that references disciplinary action.
Yes.
And that is a short and sweet way to do it.
Okay, we'd want Subsection 5 in there as well. And Section 5 and Section 7. Section 5.
Section 5 is referenced.
You got all those already.
The only thing you need is 7.
Oh, I see. So you're saying it would be redundant.
Yeah.
To cite 5. Where's 7 referenced?
7's not.
7's in there.
7.
Okay. Yeah.
You got it?
Yeah, I got it.
You got it, Ms. Talbot?
Yeah.
You got it, Senator Shoemaker?
Yeah.
Okay. We got it.
3 sub 2.
All right.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I move the amendments as amended.
You.
You're just auditing.
You got it, Senator Gretzky?
Pay the full tuition.
Your attendance merits it.
Sometimes silence is the best attendance in this community.
Okay, we'll keep you out of the line of fire, that's for sure. You okay, Senator Gretzky?
Yes.
No objection to amendments? Okay, we're going to adopt them.
Mr. Chairman, I move the bill is amended.
Got a subsequent referral or go straight out?
Straight out. I don't think there's any subsequent.
Let's take a look here just to make sure.
Straight out. Mr. Chairman, do pass.
All right.
Oops.
I'm just wondering if we need to have an engrossed addition.
Yeah, I'll get you one before I drop it at the desk so you can double check it.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that.
Okay.
Yeah, I want this read very carefully.
Yes.
And all of the cross-references and all of the...
So this will be an LC engrossed addition.
Yeah.
It will be given to us as an opportunity to blow the whistle.
Before you drop it at the desk.
Yes. Blow the whistle on this. I'm going to time out.
That's right.
Like a couple of days.
Penalty.
Yeah.
All right. And you'll let us know when you're going to drop it. I mean, here's your engrossed, and we're going
to
drop this
thing. You got 2 days to review it. Yes.
Do your homework.
Okay. Let's call the roll.
Senator Gretzky?
Aye.
Senator Gill?
Aye.
Work session.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Chair Karen?
Aye. Motion carries. And I assume Senator Hill?
Sure thing.
All right. Let you carry that little Hummer. I'm gonna take care of a couple of items of housekeeping business before we open the public hearing on these House bills, which we'll hear, and give to the members of the committee. Forewarned is forearmed. Put one on Senator Houck's place, too, will you?
Wow.
And see that one is hand-delivered to his office. The answer to the question, are we ever going to do anything about workers' compensation? The answer, as you can see, is yes.
At least we're going to
more
list.
Than you want.
At least we're going to hear about it.
You're going to hear about it. We're going to get a complete overview, and other members of the Senate will be sitting in with us from time to time as major areas of interest come up that they are concerned with, and will join us and add their perspective to it.
Okay.
These will try and fit into a. Into a 3 to 5, 5:30 kind of format. We're going to hold over most of the work sessions. We're going to try and we will have finished all Senate bills. We will have worked a number of House bills, and then we will go to full red alert for this for quite a while.
The only thing remaining to be scheduled will be Friday, Monday, and Wednesday. Friday of this week and Monday and Wednesday of next week, and those will be Senate bills.
Yeah. So we will have cleared the docket by next Friday, it says here. If there are other things which have to be done, they have to be done outside of the schedule, because I want the, when we take up the bills that are done by the House, I want everybody to be on the same plane as far as their knowledge and understanding and comprehension of what's at issue. In addition, the new members in the committee, if they wish, can have, you will find that you will have the offer, whether you want it or not, from all of the folks that are involved in these overviews, any private consultations which you wish on any of the subjects that will come up under workers' compensation. So. And, of course, our witnesses can have, I mean, anybody interested party can have this list, too, and it's going to be quite a work schedule. In fact, you can probably deliver those and bring me back the witness sheets.
Okay.
All right?
Scott wants to speak to me for a second, so let me
okay.
do that.
All right. With that, let's open the, and on Wednesday we have a 5 p.m. hearing, and I'm going to ask that the members appear here at 3 p.m. on Wednesday, at 3 p.m., because we have 2 hours between then and a 5 p.m. session.
Speak to the chairman.
I've already asked our counsel to write letters to them telling them we're going to physically come and arrest you. All right. because if we get squeezed between judiciary and ways and means, we'll never get anything done. Okay, let's open the public hearing on House Bill 2304. And the prize goes to, let's see, is it Bill Bradley?
Brawley.
Brawley, you're the winner on that one. Why don't you identify yourself for the record and have at it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Brawley. I'm the Assistant Manager of the Job Training Partnership Act Administration at the Economic Development Department. I'm here just to brief you as briefly as I can on the package of federal legislation which I think precipitated this piece you see in front of you. If you'll remember, summer of 88, spring of 88, the Omnibus Trade and Competitiveness Act, which came out of Congress, was vetoed first by the President because of its containing the early notification requirements on a plant closure. Those requirements were popped out and passed through on their own without a presidential signature. Then the trade bill passed subsequently. These things were put together as a package originally, and as far as our implementation goes, we still need to treat them as a package. So we have the early warning, the WARN, and then we have what has become the new Title III of the Job Training Partnership Act, the Economic Dislocation Worker Adjustment Assistance Act, EDWA. EDWA is our dislocated worker legislation. It does not differ a great deal from our current Title III Dislocated Worker Activities in Oregon. It does, however, mandate a state-level response to a closure, and that's where it begins to tie in with WARN. We have been designated by the governor as the entity to receive the 60-day notice. When we receive the 60-day notice, then it is our responsibility to pull together a rapid response team, which will include Employment Division, other individuals from the Economic Development Department, the local private industry council, which is our service delivery arm, and any other local players who seem appropriate to then go to that closure site and begin to deal with the situation as it exists. The whole theory here is early intervention. The sooner we can get out there, the more we can bring to bear on the situation. Our first look would be at whether or not there's any opportunity to keep the plant operating or not. Through the Stabilization and Conversion Fund, there is some money available to do that. We, through EDWA, are able to fund a pre-feasibility study for an employee buyout. If all these kinds of things fail, then our responsibility turns to the workers who are about to be dislocated and to make sure they have a single point of contact to receive all the services that are possibly available to them. We would also be looking at the community in which the dislocation occurs to see if there's anything that we can be doing to help the community. The 2304 also asks that we provide public notice of the kinds of services that are available and the things that we're about to be doing. I've included for you a bunch of stuff. First is the act itself, this little thing. Then a brochure and a cover letter that we sent out in March to any employers who had over 50 employees. A copy of a public notice that we put in most of the papers in the state. And then two articles which have appeared in the Employment Division's Labor Trends. One which talked about WARN, one which talked about EDWA. And then the top little sheet just kind of compares very briefly the provisions of the three pieces of legislation. As you can see, the 2304 basically, in a practical sense, simply requires us to report to the legislature and the governor over and above what we would already be doing under the federal legislation. The last attachment I have for you is a list of the WARN notices that we have received since it went into effect in February. Now, in this interim period between February and the 1st of July, we are dealing with closures under the old dislocated worker legislation, which puts the responsibility for the most part at the local level. If they don't have the resources, either in terms of people or finance to deal with the situation, then they come back to us and we have a reserve fund to help them out. We also have access to a Secretary of Labor's discretionary grant fund. If there is not enough money in the state to deal with the dislocation, then we can go to the feds. We have used that one in several places around the state in the last few years. The most current is the Caterpillar closure out here in Dallas. So we are on track to get this thing in place by the 1st of July. And we'll be able to provide the appropriate reports to you shortly after the end of our program year next summer.
All right.
Thank you, Chair.
Senator Grant.